Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 475, titled Prior Offenses. Prior, by the way, is spelled P-R-Y-O-R, for reasons that will become clear as the broadcast continues. This program is being recorded on September 12th of the year 2004. We're going to be revisiting a subject that I talk about a lot on this program, not only some of the American industrialists and financiers who backed Hitler. We're going to revisit the subject of the 1934 coup attempt in the United States. This year is the 70th anniversary of that very important, though little-known, event. We're going to be taking a look, too, at some of the Bush family's links with Nazi industry and how some of those links may have played out in the late World War II and post-World War II periods. However, before we get into the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you that all of the various programs and lectures that I've done over the years are on permanent record with a CD duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California. Capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D. Zip is 95005. You can visit the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com, and there are a number of features that await you there. First of all, in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com, there are detailed, annotated, article-length descriptions of each of the For the Record programs. There are various pages to click on to learn about the descriptions for the Record shows, the archive shows, lectures, etc. Then, also on the Spitfire website, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, a vital text by the late heroic Paul Manning, is available for download on the Spitfire website. And also, there's a search function and now a link to a website that has been put together by some listeners in the Midwest. That website has some of the actual documents, declassified U.S. government documents, proving Prescott Bush Sr.'s involvement with Nazi industry, including and especially Prescott Bush's involvement with institutions that were doing business with firms that were helping the Nazis effect their post-war flight capital program. This puts Prescott Bush Sr. in the milieu of the Bormann flight capital program. Also, be aware that on the Spitfire website, there are links to two very important websites maintained by sister station WFMU. Those programs, again, maintained by WFMU, or those websites, rather, have the various For the Record programs available on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL. Link to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Okay, so please take advantage of these remarkable resources. I'm going to be utilizing a document downloaded from the website maintained by listeners in the Midwest later on in the program. One of my favorite phrases that I use on this program, or have used over the years, is that basically, if you don't study history, the world is a mystery. Read or bleed, learn or burn. And what we're going to be doing is taking a look in the past, and we're going to be taking a look at some of the alliances and some of the connections of the Bush family in the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II periods. In a number of different broadcasts, I've talked about the fact that many of the American industrialists and financiers in the 20s, 30s, and 40s backed Adolf Hitler for a number of reasons. Some liked the anti-communist and anti-labor stance of fascism. Some were simply cynics who would invest in anything that figured to offer a profit. And Nazi industry, in particular munitions-related industry, seemed to be a good investment at the time. Among the families that was involved with this milieu, as we've seen so many times, is the Bush family. We've talked about the Nazi American industrial connections in many programs, including Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the first two RFA shows, RFA 10, which you're going to hear excerpted later, and many, many different For the Record shows dealing with, among other connections, again, the Bush family's links to this same milieu. What we're going to be taking a look at is in the early part of the program, and one of the things from which the broadcast takes its name is a family named Pryor, P-R-Y. O-R. And specifically, we're going to be taking a look at Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. and his son, Samuel Pryor Jr. We're going to begin by looking at Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. He was the head of the Remington firm. That was the largest small arms manufacturer in the United States. It eventually was bought out by the DuPont firm. And as we're going to see in a few minutes, the Remington firm was also the company that was tabbed by the 1934 Kuplot conspirators to provide weapons to the 1934 would-be Koopsters. So we're going to talk about that in just a minute. Samuel Fraser Pryor also, however, was an intimate of the Walker slash Bush slash Harriman business milieu, and he was a key director of a triumvirate of Bush-connected firms, the Union Banking Corporation and the American Ship and Commerce Corporation, which was the parent company of the German Hamburg America Line. Samuel Fraser Pryor was a key director of both of those companies, both UBC and Hamburg America. And in turn, as we've seen in many programs, Hamburg America Line and the Union Banking Corporation were not only firms that involved George Herbert Walker, the current seated president's great-grandfather, but also Prescott Bush Sr., the current seated president's grandfather and father of George Bush, president number 41. What we're going to look at during the course of this first part of the broadcast is Samuel Fraser Pryor's presence as a key director of Union Banking Corporation and also of American Ship and Commerce. And this places Samuel Fraser Pryor in the milieu that was not only conspiring successfully to help arm and finance Adolf Hitler, but also places him in the milieu that was conspiring unsuccessfully to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And again, the Remington Arms firm, by 1934, a DuPont subsidiary, was tabbed to provide the weapons to the 1934 coup plotters. So in the first part of Pryor offenses, we're going to be taking a look at Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. and his position as a key director of Union Banking Corporation, one of the Bush and Thiessen family's Nazi-linked businesses. Union Banking Corporation enabled George Herbert Walker to begin channeling money to the Nazi cause courtesy of Fritz Thiessen as early as 1934. Another thing we're going to look at in this first part of the program concerns the fact that Remington Arms, as was discussed in the Nye-Vandenberg Committee hearings in the early 30s, Remington Arms also found their way to German rightists, including Nazi Party members in the early 1930s, and it was those Remington Arms that helped to overthrow democracy in Germany and to install fascism. And one of the questions that's raised by Kevin Phillips, an author here, is whether the Hamburg America Line may very well have been used to ship those Remington arms to the Nazis and other German rightists in the early 1930s. One of the questions that Kevin Phillips raises is whether or not Samuel Fraser Pryor may have had something to do with this. As a director of the parent company of Hamburg America Line, and as a director of Union Banking Corporation, both of those connections placing Samuel Fraser Pryor in a position of being part of the Bush-Harriman business milieu. Samuel Fraser Pryor was the head of Remington Arms. Now, we're going to take a look at what author Kevin Phillips has to say about the Nye-Vandenberg Committee hearings. The Nye-Vandenberg Committee was a congressional committee put together in the early 1930s to investigate the munitions industry. They investigated the munitions industry's monopolistic practices in World War I, their role in helping to stimulate conflicts from which they then profited, and in particular, the Nye-Vandenberg Committee was looking into American munitions manufacturers and their efforts in Europe during the early 1930s. And again, one of the things that the Nye-Vandenberg Committee uncovered was the fact that Remington Arms had found their way to German rightists, including members of the Nazi Party in the early 1930s, thereby enabling the overthrow, to a certain extent, of the Weimar Republic. What we're going to look at now is Samuel Fraser Pryor's role, not only as the head of Remington Arms, but his position as a key director of the Union Banking Corporation, one of the Bush family's Nazi-connected businesses, and also as a key director of the parent company, the American Ship and Commerce Corporation's parent company ownership of the German Hamburg America Line. Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. was a key director of American Ship and Commerce, and Kevin Phillips speculates about the possibility that that may have enabled, that is to say, Pryor and his role with the Hamburg America Line may have enabled the Remington Arms to find their way to German rightists, including the Nazis, in the early 1930s. We're going to turn to a book that I've used many times in the past. That book is called American Dynasty, authored by Kevin Phillips. It's about the Bush family, and in connection with the Nye Vandenberg Committee hearings and some of the investment banking choices made by the Bush family in the early 1920s, we read, by the way, the Bush here is Prescott Bush Sr. The Walker is his father-in-law, George Herbert Walker. They are respectively the grandfather and great-grandfather of the current seated president. Of the Nye Vandenberg Committee hearings and their findings of the fact that Remington Arms found their way to German rightists in the early 30s, we read, "But Bush and Walker did know some of the reviled merchants, the World War I-era munitions makers, armor trust members, and arms manufacturers being investigated during the early New Deal years. Both men knew Samuel Fraser Pryor, the former president of Remington Arms, whose firm was queried by the Nye Committee about the clandestine flow of American weaponry to Germany through Holland in the early 1930s. Walker was not investigated by the committee, but the American Ship and Commerce Corporation's partial ownership and influence over the German Hamburg America line may have helped Remington Firearms reach right-wing political factions in the early 1930s. The guns were probably illicitly transferred, without inconvenient police inspection, to German-bound river barges in Holland's Schelde estuaries." So again, Samuel Fraser Pryor, head of Remington. Remington Arms found their way to German rightists, including Nazis, in the early 1930s. Speculation there about the possibility that it may have been the Hamburg-America line that helped those arms to reach that destination. Skipping down, Kevin Phillips writes still further about Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr.'s involvement with the Bush-Harriman business milieu that linked the Bush family to Third Reich industry. As we're going to see, Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr. carried on that family tradition. He ultimately became a key director of Harriman Securities Corporation. Of the Fraser Pryor Sr. and Jr.'s involvement with the Bush-Harriman business milieu, in turn linking it to the Third Reich's business milieu, we read, "Remington Samuel Pryor was part of this cabal and took a role in the first big Harriman-Walker international gambit, the arrangement of a major participation in Germany's once great Hamburg America steamship line. Harriman and Walker held their Hamburg America shares through another mutual framework, the American Ship and Commerce Corporation. Pryor was named one of AS&C's directors. In 1924, when Harriman and Walker set up the Union Banking Corporation in New York on behalf of the politically active German steel baron Fritz Thyssen, control of UBC was held by a Dutch entity, the Rotterdam-based Bank for Handel and Scheepvaart. This Dutch bank, in turn, was owned by Berlin's August Thyssen Bank. The Rotterdam Bank, it has been proven, handled some of Thyssen's 1920s contributions to the fledgling Nazi Party. For some reason, Samuel Pryor of Remington was named an original director of UBC. He seems to have been a tight third side of the Harriman-German triangle. Indeed, after he died in 1934, his son became a director of Harriman Securities Corporation, joining the two Harriman brothers, Averill and Roland. This does make one wonder about Remington-made arms going to Thyssen or Thyssen's friends." And as we're going to see, that year, 1934, the year in which Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. died, was a very, very portentous year. In For the Record program number 448, recorded earlier this year being 2004, we took a look at the 1934 coup attempt. The 70th anniversary of that very important event is being celebrated this year, or at least this is the 70th anniversary. I can't say as anybody is going to be celebrating it. But we're going to take a look now at the 1934 coup attempt, in which many of the same industrialists and financiers who had backed Hitler, and many of whom were also associates of George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr., plotted to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt in a fascist coup in 1934. That coup was blocked when General Smedley Butler of the Marines, who had been selected to lead that coup, basically blew the coup to Franklin Roosevelt and in turn to the press. Another congressional committee was put together to investigate that, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, and their report, even though they went to great lengths to save the prominent people behind the coup embarrassment, ultimately their report, that congressional committee's report, confirmed what Smedley Butler had to say about the 34 coup attempt. Now note that the arms for the 34 coup attempt were to be provided by Remington, which had already successfully provided arms to German rightists who were plotting against the Weimar Republic, including Nazis. The following is an excerpt from For the Record Program 448. It's also in turn excerpted from RFA number 10, recorded on July 11th of 1985. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable co-host, Nip Tuck, or former co-host, Nip Tuck. The text we're reading from is Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham, put together in softcover and published by Signet.
Early in 1934, Irenée DuPont and Knudsen reached their explosion point over President Roosevelt. Along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, recall that the Morgan Financial Group includes DuPont Chemicals, Morgan Bank, and General Motors, beginning again, along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, certain DuPont backers financed a coup d'etat that would overthrow the president with the aid of a $3 million funded army of terrorists modeled on the fascist movement in Paris known as the Croix de Feu. Who was to be the figurehead for this ill-advised scheme which would result in Roosevelt being forced to take orders from businessmen as part of a fascist government or face the alternative of imprisonment and execution? DuPont men allegedly held an urgent series of meetings with the Morgans. They finally settled on one of the most popular soldiers in America, General Smedley Butler of Pennsylvania. Butler, a brave hero, had been awarded 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, and his brilliant career as Commandant of the Marine Corps had made him a legend. He would, the conspiratorial group felt, make an ideal replacement for Roosevelt if the latter proved difficult. These business chiefs found great support for their plan in Hermann Schmitz, Baron von Schroeder, and the other German members of the fraternity. Interrupting here, the fraternity is a name that Charles Higham has applied to this cozy group of German and American industrialists and financiers who formed what I guess for lack of a better term we could call this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that essentially was the focus of our Uncle Sam in the broadcast and which we're looking at in part tonight. So that's what Higham means here by the fraternity. Continuing, the backers of the bizarre conspiracy selected a smooth attorney, Gerald McGuire, to bring word of the plan to General Butler. McGuire agreed Butler would be the perfect choice. Butler had attacked the New Deal in public speeches. McGuire met with Butler at the latter's house in Newton Square, Pennsylvania, and in a hotel suite nearby. With great intensity, the fascist attorney delivered the scheme to the general. Butler was horrified. Although there were many things about Roosevelt he disliked, a coup d'etat amounted to treason, and Butler was nothing if not loyal to the Constitution. However, he disclosed nothing of his feelings. With masterful composure, he pretended interest and waited to hear more. When McGuire returned, it was with news of more millions and more extravagant plans, which included turning America into a dictatorship with Butler as a kind of Hitler. Once more, Butler was infuriated but kept quiet. After McGuire left on the second occasion, the general got in touch with the White House. He told Roosevelt of the entire plan. Roosevelt's state of mind can scarcely be imagined. He knew that in view of the backing from high banking sources, this matter could not be dismissed as some crackpot enterprise that had no chance of success. He was well aware of the powerful forces of fascism that could easily make America an ally of Nazism, even that early, only 1 year after Hitler had risen to power. On the other hand, Roosevelt also knew that if he were to arrest the leaders of the houses of Morgan and DuPont, it would create an unthinkable national crisis in the midst of a depression and perhaps another Wall Street crash. Not for the first or last time in his career, he was aware that there were powers greater than he in the United States. That's worth mentioning here, worth remembering here, that Roosevelt was quite aware that he was not the most powerful man in the country. John Kennedy found that out the hard way. Nevertheless, the plan had to be deactivated immediately. The answer was to leak it to the press. The newspaper ran the story of the attempted coup on the front page, but generally ridiculed it as absurd and preposterous. When Thomas Lamont of the Morgan Bank arrived from Europe by steamer, he was asked by a crowd of reporters to comment. "Perfect moonshine, too utterly ridiculous to comment upon," unquote, was the reply. Roosevelt couldn't quite let the matter rest. Under pressure from liberal Democrats, he set up a special House committee to investigate. Butler begged the committee to summon the DuPonts, but the committee declined, nor would it consent to call anyone from the House of Morgan. Then Butler dropped a bombshell. He gave interviews to the press announcing that none other than General Douglas MacArthur was a party to the plot. This again was dismissed by the press, and MacArthur laughed it off. Interrupting here, MacArthur was chief of staff of the Army. That's one of the reasons this was such a bombshell. Before Nip Tuck continues here, note here that we have some of the most powerful financiers and industrialists in America financing a proposed military coup d'etat. This is a matter of public record, although the record has been obscured. It's worth underscoring the point here because most Americans don't really think of the United States as a place where a military coup might take place, and our point is that this has been attempted in the past.
The committee hearings were a farce. McGuire was allowed to get away with saying that Butler had, quote, misunderstood his intentions. Other witnesses lamely made excuses, and there the matter rested. It was 4 years before the committee dared to publish its report in a white paper that was marked for, quote, restricted circulation. They were forced to admit that, quote, certain persons made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. The committee was able to verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler, unquote. This admission that the entire plan was deadly in intent was not accompanied by the imprisonment of anybody. Further investigations disclosed that over 1 million people had been guaranteed to join the scheme, and that the arms and munitions necessary would have been supplied by Remington, a DuPont subsidiary.
That again from For the Record Program 448, recorded earlier this year. In turn, that was excerpted from RFA number 10, recorded on July 11, 1985. The text was from the book Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham. Now again, note that in 1934, which coincidentally was the year in which Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. passed away, in 1934, many of the power elite of the United States, including a milieu to which the Bush family belonged, were plotting to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt. And again, Remington arms had been successfully channeled to the German right, including members of the Nazi Party in the early 1930s. Author Kevin Phillips here speculates about the possibility that Samuel Fraser Pryor, the head of Remington and a key director of not only Union Banking Corporation, but also Hamburg America Line, both of the latter Bush family Nazi-linked businesses. Kevin Phillips speculates about the possible role of the Hamburg America Line and Samuel Fraser Pryor's influence with it in helping to get those Remington arms to the German rightists and the Nazis in the early 1930s. One wonders, and obviously this is a speculative element, one wonders about the possibility of Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. being involved with the 34 coup plotters. One wonders also whether George Herbert Walker or Prescott Bush Sr. were involved with those coup plotters. They were part of the same general milieu. It would be interesting to learn if they were involved or not in the 34 coup attempt. Now, note that the 34 coup attempt was unsuccessful. Note that Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. died in 1934. Again, I wonder whether perhaps he was involved in that coup plotting, whether perhaps the strain of the situation brought about his death. One wonders if perhaps he was one of the plotters and was perhaps given a ticket to ride, and that accounts for his exit in 1934. Again, let me stress very strongly those are speculative elements. But certainly the family tradition was carried on, and as indicated in this passage, Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr. became a key operative of this same business milieu. Repeating once again from Kevin Phillips, indeed, after he, Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr., died in 1934, his son became a director of Harriman Securities Corporation, joining the two Harriman brothers, Averill and Roland. This does make one wonder about Remington-made arms going to Thiessen or Thiessen's friends. We're going to take a look now at Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr. and some plotting that he was a party to, once again plotting against Franklin Delano Roosevelt, once again plotting to have him removed from office, and once again doing so on behalf of the Third Reich. We're turning now to a book called Mystery Man. That book was authored by Dale Harrington. It's a biography of William Rhodes Davis, American Nazi Agent of Influence. The full title of the book, Mystery Man, William Rhodes Davis, American Nazi Agent of Influence. This book was published in softcover by Brassies and copyright 1999. Now, the focal point of the book, this mystery man of the title, is a guy named William Rhodes Davis, a very powerful, very successful Texas businessman involved with a number of businesses, including and especially the oil business. William Rhodes Davis was also ardently pro-Hitler and eventually became a registered agent of the German government in the United States. He was actually an Abwehr agent, a German intelligence agent. The Germans very much wanted to get rid of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, whom they saw as their primary obstacle in the on the American political landscape. And so in 1940, the Germans began energetically working to try to effect Roosevelt's defeat. One of the things they did was to channel $5 million to the Republican Party of the United States through William Rhodes Davis and some of his associates in order to defeat Franklin Roosevelt. So in this presidential election year, and also the 70th anniversary of the 1934 coup attempt, it's worth bearing in mind that some of the campaign funds that the Republicans utilized in 1940 came from the Third Reich, courtesy of William Rhodes Davis. Now, two of the things that the Germans and William Rhodes Davis and the Republicans were conspiring to do in order to defeat Roosevelt were, first of all, to finance, obviously, anti-Roosevelt activities, and specifically John L. Lewis, the head of the American Mine Workers and also the Congress of Industrial Organizations and a critic of Franklin Roosevelt and a hero to many of the blue-collar workers in the United States. John L. Lewis was paid to do a speech on behalf of Wendell Willkie, the Republican nominee, in 1940. And specifically, the efforts to get John L. Lewis's profile raised as highly as possible, and the machinations behind this nationwide speech in which John L. Lewis attempted to get labor to support Willkie and defeat Roosevelt. This was arranged by German intelligence agent William Rhodes Davis, utilizing monies channeled to the Republican Party from Nazi Germany. Now, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, when these machinations were going on, was none other than Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr., the son of Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr., whom we just looked at. And William Rhodes Davis' Nazi affiliations were quite well known at this time. They had been published in the major media. He was a very influential person, so he wasn't burned, at least not at this point in time. But the point being that Samuel Fraser Pryor, as head of the Republican National Committee, would no doubt have been aware of the activities of William Rhodes Davis on behalf of Nazi Germany. And again, he was a Nazi spy. So in terms of evaluating Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr.'s behavior in connection with this attempt by Nazi Germany to interfere in the American elections of 1940 and effect the defeat of Franklin Roosevelt, that certainly has to have been known. The German affiliations of William Rhodes Davis certainly would have to have been known to Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr. We're going to take a look at this episode in history now, and throughout much of the rest of the broadcast. Again, the time is 1940. Franklin Roosevelt is running for re-election for a third term, and the Germans very much want to defeat him, and they're channeling money in order to effect that defeat. Turning now to the book Mystery Man, William Rhodes Davis, American Nazi Agent of Influence by Dale Harrington, we read, "The Germans decided to surreptitiously help Willkie through secret contributions to the various pro-Willkie political clubs. To avoid the political ruin of their American friends should the Americans seize the German embassy, Thompson had all receipts and statements that described who received payments from the Germans destroyed. Just how much the Germans spent on the 1940 presidential campaign and who received the money will never be known for sure. Whether Davis and Herzlitz spent all $5 million of their funds on Willkie's campaign is unclear. Supposedly, $3 million of the money that Podesta delivered to the Germans was found in the German embassy when the FBI seized it in December of 1941. Whether the other $2 million was spent on the Republicans is not known. Some of this money may have been sent to Democratic Party candidates that the Germans favored. The Germans also had other sources of money. Where this other money went and how much there was is also unknown. The entire flow of German money to the presidential election campaigns is murky. What is known is that total Republican presidential expenditures in 1940 were almost $15 million. Regardless of whether the Germans spent only $2 million or the entire $5 million or possibly even more, a large percentage of the Republican Party's funds in 1940 came from Adolf Hitler." And specifically inside two of this program, we're going to take a look at how William Rhodes Davis and Samuel Fraser Pryor cooperated in order to help get some of that German money channeled to getting John L. Lewis, the head of the United Mine Workers, head of Congress of Industrial Organizations, and a respected labor leader, to endorse Willkie in an attempt to defeat Franklin Roosevelt. However, we're going to look at that inside two of this program. That concludes side one of For the Record program number 475, Prior Offenses, being recorded on September 12, 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.